Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. You probably wouldn't think of the chainsaw as a big polluter, but it is, and that's because it literally spits off most of the oil that's applied to it during its operation. The Alberta Research Council has just finished testing a new chainsaw lubricant. It's made out of canola oil, and the results are very encouraging. However, that's not the case on the gambling front. Dr. Robert Williams of the University of Lethbridge says gambling is something that touches all segments of society, yet it is one of the most under-researched areas in health. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Those Canada geese just lovely. That's the sound I heard from a mating pair swimming on the pond in front of the Alberta Research Council the other day when I stopped by to find out about biolubricants. And with the growing interest in the use of plant materials as alternate resources, it was inevitable that someone would come up with a lubricant or grease made from vegetable oil. When you consider 1 liter of lubricant can contaminate 1 million liters of water, there's a tremendous incentive to find more environmentally friendly substitutes. The Alberta Research Council recently tested a biolubricant made from canola oil, and they did this for the Alberta Agriculture, Food and Rural Development Department. The biolubricant was tested on chainsaws and compared to a conventional lubricant with a mineral or petroleum base. Tom Kusick is a senior research technologist with the Fuels and Lubricants Group at the Alberta Research Council.
What you have is metal-to-metal wear friction. So what the lubricant does is provide a surface to eliminate wear on the chain and the bar. So, I mean, it's a dollar-cents thing where if you didn't have lubricant, obviously your chain would wear out. So what conventionally is used, a conventional or a mineral oil-based type product, or petroleum-based, I should say, is a conventional fuel or oil in which you put in your chain bar. You'll have different grades for summer and winter. And obviously, you'll have thinner for winter and thicker for the summertime. What we did is compare this here conventional lubricant to a biolubricant, which is made from canola or vegetable oil. And this here was used in a comparison to check the two different products.
How did you set up your experiment?
We put forward several proposals to Alberta Agriculture in regards to how we were going to do it. One was we were initially going to use a harvester in which the harvester actually is used in taking down large trees, cutting them and falling them, and it utilizes a chain and bar system as well. But we felt that there was too many unknown factors. So what we did is we decided to use a chainsaw mill. So we used this chainsaw mill, which held a Husqvarna chainsaw in place, and we could monitor cutting speeds. We could monitor oil consumption. We could maintain a lot of the parameters that would otherwise, you know, you couldn't control. So it was much more controlled testing. So we were able to cut poplar trees, and we could monitor the quantity that was cut and compare the two oils by cutting the same amount of product. And then we also measured the wear of the chain and the bar and such.
Well, just looking at the picture you showed me, you're actually doing this as a real sawyer because you're out there with the long pieces of wood and running them through the mill. How did you actually run these pieces through?
Basically, the technique that was used is it's a sawmill, so the log would be placed on a bed. It was stationary, and you would push the saw through the wood at a speed that basically wouldn't bog the saw down, so it was kind of a trial and error at first. What we did is we took all the bark off to eliminate any of the possible dirt contamination. And when we did the final process, we only used raw wood that didn't have bark, so that you didn't get any dirt or possible metal or anything that was sitting on the outside of the tree. So what you did is you traversed down. It was about a 16-foot long cut. We cut lumber from the trees in 6-inch, 4-inch, and 2-inch pieces. And we kept cutting that repeatedly and, again, keeping the same amount of of length of cut, so that, you know, it was a direct comparison. We had more control over everything then.
What did you find out then when once you went through this test and sawed up all this wood?
What we did is we did a comparison of the bar and the chain wear, and this would give a relative indication of how good the lubricant was. So what we did is we took the bar and we did some measurements cross sections to determine the width of the bar prior to any cutting, and then we repeated those measurements after all the cutting was completed. And what that gave us was a table of various specifications on the two chains and bars. And by doing that, basically by comparing everything, you could see that the biolubricant actually provided from the data, in this case, is that the biolubricant actually produced less wear over conventional lubricants. And you can visually see this as well in the chain.
Yeah, because looking at the one, it's much shinier than the other. What does that tell you? Is it better to be shiny or not?
Well, the chains, when they're new, they have a grayish tinge to them. And what the shininess is telling you is that the outside coating has actually been wore away. So it's better to not have the shininess, so you're getting better lubricant.
Well, why would that be?
Our study, we actually found that we used less of the biolubricant, approximately 8-9% less in the cutting. So actually it was a little bit more efficient as well.
Well, it sounds like it's doing pretty well. Are there any drawbacks to this biolubricant?
On the initial testing, we found that with pore point depressants and stuff, you can make the biolubricant go lower. But currently, the one we compared, and it might be because it's a wide-range lubricant, where we did actually test only the winter product for the commercial lubricant, and the pore point was a little higher, which means that it wouldn't pour at as cold a temperature as the winter commercial lubricant. But there are techniques to make the biolubricant go lower as well. But this one we tested didn't have the pore point or wasn't as low as the commercial lubricant. So it would be, if you're cutting in minus 30 or 40 weather, it might be a consideration that you'd have to address.
How does this fit into the bigger picture? Is this like an opening market for bioproducts?
I believe that it has great potential. I mean, it is a renewable resource, and potentially, well, we never did a market study to see, you know, what the actual impact would be as far as amount sold, but I've read studies that indicate that when you're chainsawing, you can use up to, you know, 0.8 liters of oil per hour in a chainsaw, and I don't know what the number of chainsaws are out there, but there's a large number, and if all those are going for an hour and all that oil is being lost into the environment, it is a substantial amount of oil being just thrown away and wasted.
How does it get lost to the environment? Where does it go? Does it sort of dissipate into the air or get pushed off into little droplets as the chainsaw is moving?
Part of the technique the chainsaw uses is they just actually add oil to the chain. So as the chain is spinning, when it's running free, what it does is actually slings off the chain. So it's a lost oil. And they consider that to be a free loss oil, this here method or this technique. So it's getting disposed of basically by lubricating the chain in an excess amount, and any excess that's above the lubrication is obviously thrown off. And that right directly into the environment, onto the person cutting, dogs, trees, whatever's around in some cases. So it gets thrown around. So you don't want to be throwing oil. I mean, it makes common sense. You don't want to be throwing oil on yourself. I mean, people for years have said, hey, don't get oil on you, right? You clean yourself. So what better to have something that's probably a biolubricant that's probably less harmful to yourself?
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you.
That was Tom Cusick, a senior research technologist with the Fuels and Lubricants Group at the Alberta Research Council. Also part of the team testing the biolubricant was Dr. Xiaomei Li, a senior scientist in the Environmental Technologies Unit at the Alberta Research Council. Her job was to look at the environmental impact of the biolubricant.
We basically did three tests. All three tests are based on a kind of soil test. Assumption was made that we think if this, because it is used for the chainsaw, right? In case there's a limited spill out, and normally you're talking about with land for either forest land or agroforest land, and how well that will affect the vegetation. Three tests we did, we normally, first two considered as ecotoxicity test, And one is our research council, we have developed a simple, really quick test using seeds. In this case, we choose lettuce, which is a sensitive species to any kind of a contaminant. What we did is put the lubricant into the soil, and we put the seeds on the top. We'll see whether seeds will germinate or not. Germination is a wonderful indicator as well. If the more toxic, the plants will have a tough time to germinate. After germination, you will see the quicker root grow and also shoot grow. So we measured how long root can grow and how long shoot can grow in a certain period of the time.
What did you find in comparing the two different oils, the conventional and the biolubricant?
We find out that the biolubricant has much less impact to the root growth than the conventional lubricant in the concentration we tested.
So were the lettuce roots longer?
Yeah, yes, indeed. They grow longer in certain time.
And what was the second test?
Second test was we look at the soil microbe community. You know, the soil is quite a life thing, right? So many microbe, bacteria, fungus in there. If any environmental pollutant come to the soil, what the damage it could do is wipe out a certain microbe population. That's the second test we did. We find out biolubricant has much less impact compared to conventional oil.
And the third test?
Third test was we so-called biodigestibility. See if this lubricant put in the soil, how fast they can be degraded. And in this case, biolubricant will degrade much faster than conventional oil.
How does it degrade?
Basically, there's a soil microbe will break down, use carbon as their energy source and break down to the water and the carbon.
What is your overall thoughts then, having done the test and having looked at the results? What's your overall conclusion?
From only this three tests, I would say it's a quick test and it's not comprehensive yet. But based on those three tests, indicate biolubricant have a much less environmental impact compared to a conventional lubricant.
Now that you've completed all this, do you see that there's more work to be done?
Yes, I think this is the three only, from the environmental side, we only did the three quick tests. I would like to see a little bit longer term, see how in this real situation will be. For example, some field tests probably will be more meaningful.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Dr. Xiaomei Li, a senior research scientist at the Environmental Technologies Unit at the Alberta Research Council. I also spoke with her colleague, Tom Cusick. With the announcement of yet more casinos to be built in Alberta, it seems that not a week goes by without some news on the gambling front. Dr. Robert Williams is an assistant professor in the School of Health Sciences at the University of Lethbridge, where he's part of the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. He considers gambling to be a very under-researched area, and the books on the shelves in Robert's office are a testament to that fact. I was hard-pressed to find many on gambling among all those about other forms of addiction and abuse.
Well, it's a tiny fraction. I mean, I've got a handful of books there. There's lots of government reports and a lot of gray literature, but the amount of academic literature in gambling is very tiny compared to most other areas of psychopathology or other addictions.
Why is it that we're getting so interested in gaming and gambling right now?
Well, we're in the business now. I mean, most governments and, you know, it's a worldwide phenomenon. In the last 10, 20 years, gambling's become a worldwide passion, interest, and business. So we're in the business, and the research is sort of trying to catch up to it to help guide policy, et cetera.
With the research that you've been doing lately, you've been trying to get a handle on the different populations. What populations are you looking at, and what are you finding out?
Well, we're looking at all the populations. I deal with adolescents, seniors, aboriginals. It's hard to know where to start. I mean, one of the projects I'm involved in is development of prevention programs in the high school, because unlike other areas of potential addictions, there doesn't exist any effective gambling prevention programs in the high school. So that's one area we've been working on. There's some controversy in the field about how serious a problem gambling is for adolescents, but there's less controversy about young adults having high rates. And so one area that needs work is the development of effective prevention programs.
You've had some success with that, though.
Yes. After about 3 years of research and fine-tuning our program, I think we've come up with the world's first empirically validated program that actually changes gambling behavior. It's not hard to change people's knowledge or attitudes towards something, but it's very difficult to actually change their behavior. So after a lot of work and development, I think we've reached that. We have a pretty spiffy program. It's a 5-session program that significantly decreases adolescents' subsequent likelihood of engaging in any sort of gambling after exposure to our program. So we're quite pleased about that.
What's the magic ingredient there that changes behavior?
One thing, the important thing we learned was there was no single magic ingredient. That you have to cover all the bases. So we talk about, the odds in gambling. They're all against you. We talked about gambling can be as addictive as drugs or alcohol. But we also covered general risky behavior, because most people who are problem gamblers are also have other addictions. And being at risk of one addiction makes you more prone to others. And so a good part of our program deals with generic decision-making skills, generic problem-solving skills, and generic risk assessment. And the analogy we pose to high school students is that everything you do in life is a gamble, and what differentiates some people from others is their ability to correctly assess the risks and make the right decisions. And the people who do that are also the people less likely to make the mistake of getting involved in gambling. So it's all of those elements that seem to be important, because we've done other investigations that have looked at just increasing people's knowledge of the odds involved in gambling and found that that alone is ineffective.
So what would be different then about being at high school age and being able to take this information in and act on it and change behavior, as opposed to someone who's maybe 40 or 60 years old who has been gambling, and you're trying to reach them to help them change their behavior?
The few unique things about the adolescents in that a lot of them are very, very naive about gambling. They know very little about it, and they have fairly neutral or even slightly positive attitudes about it. They haven't seen directly the impacts as much as adults. And so changing their attitudes or opening their eyes about the risks involved seems to occur a lot more dramatically with the adolescents than the adults, who already know, a lot of the risks. And so it'd be a different message for the adults.
Well, I guess, too, you're dealing with prevention as opposed to trying to change someone who's already involved.
Right. And that is a fundamental difference, that a lot of adolescents are involved in casual, bets on the Super Bowl sort of thing or on a pool game, but very few of them have played VLTs yet or been to the blackjack table. They haven't been exposed yet to the main forms of gambling which are causing problems in our society.
Well, going from one extreme, from the high school age to seniors, what have you found out about seniors so far?
It's an interesting contradiction, and a couple of my colleagues here at the university, Gary Nixon and Christopher Rose, are sort of leading this research, but It's an interesting problem in that you go into any casino, and the majority of people you see there, any time of day or night, tend to be an older crowd. And yet all the prevalence studies indicate that older people supposedly have the lowest rates of problem gambling. Nobody knows which is right, whether, you know, seniors are just very frugal and aren't getting into trouble, or whether the existing assessment instruments are not adequately capturing the phenomenology of problem gambling in seniors. And so Gary and Christopher have examined what does problem gambling look like in seniors, and it's different in nature. I mean, I don't have the results of that at the tip of my fingers, but it's more notions that the machines are crooked, or I mean, a lot of the assessment criteria for to be a problem gambler on the existing instruments are you're having conflicts with friends and family, or that you're having financial problems. Well, that might not apply to someone who's retired and getting a pension. They might be whittling away their savings but aren't having any immediate financial problems. They may be widows or widowers not living with extended family, so there may not be any immediate conflicts. So we're understanding that the problems manifest themselves in different ways.
You've also done some work with prison populations. What have you found there?
That's a very interesting study. I just completed a literature review that looked at the prevalence of problem and pathological gambling amongst incarcerated populations around the world. And I gathered all the literature together for the first time, and it was really fairly startling finding. If the research can be believed, and there's been 27, 28 different studies from Australia, New Zealand, Britain, U.S., if the studies can be believed that one-third of incarcerated populations are current problem gamblers, and if so, that's considerably higher than the prevalence rate found in any other population to date. The relevant thing there is that there's hardly any treatment specific to gambling and problem gambling in prisons, unlike modules for substance abuse and sexual violence. There's virtually nothing for problem gambling, and yet that seems to be a high concentration of problem gamblers.
Are they gambling in the prisons while they're there, or what exactly is happening?
Really difficult issue to study because every jurisdiction officially prohibits it. That being said, in these surveys, roughly 40 to 50% of prisoners will still acknowledge gambling on a regular basis in the prison system, even though it's an offense. Again, it's obviously not VLTs, but it's betting on the hockey game, it's card games, it's always something to gamble on. And even though there may not be money, there might be other things, cigarettes or confectionery that are gambled. And the other thing is that it seems to be the problem gamblers predominantly who still engage in gambling in prisons. And, you know, it's often seen in relatively benign terms by prison staff. What's the harm in it? It's minor amounts of goods, and it's entertainment. But my point would be it's no different from turning a blind eye to drug use amongst substance abusers. I mean, that's why they got in prison in the first place. And so part of what this review paper is trying to do is illustrate the prevalence of problem gambling in the prison population and the fact we need to do a lot more about there's a lot of opportunity to intervene in such a concentrated group in the prisons.
One of the areas that people always want to ask about with gambling revenues is how much of that is actually coming from people who are problem gamblers?
It's been a very controversial issue up till now in that the American Gaming Association stance has for a long time has been that only a very small proportion of revenues come from problem gamblers, as you would expect the industry to argue. Now, there's been a couple of studies, one in Australia, one in New Zealand, one in the States, that suggest that the actual portion is actually a fairly substantial number. Problem is the numbers are variable. Australia reported 1/3, the United States reported 15%. So we've done a couple of investigations here in Canada to try and answer the question for the Canadian context. First thing we did was do a secondary analysis of all the existing studies in all the provinces that have been done in the last 3 or 4 years. And because all of those studies have asked gamblers, how much do you spend on gambling in a typical month? And what we've done is broke that into the type of gambler that's responding, whether it's a problem gambler or a non-problem gambler, and then look at what total portion of the reported expenditures are accounted for by those problem gamblers. And we've just had, we've just summarized that data, and it's been accepted for publication. And if the results are to be believed, then 23% of Canadian gaming revenue is from the 3 or 4% of the Canadian population who are problem gamblers.
So you're talking about almost a quarter.
A quarter of the revenue, yeah. Now, there's a big qualification with that, and that is gamblers are notoriously unreliable in reporting what they've won or lost. I mean, you know, my dad goes to Casino-rama once a week, and he never loses. You know, gamblers never lose. It's important that the revenues that are actually accounted for by the government match up with the reported expenditures. And so we looked at that, and somewhat surprisingly, the reported expenditures were double the actual revenues. They weren't much less, as you might anticipate, what was found in Australia and the United States. You know, maybe it's a cultural thing. Actually, in the United States, when they asked people how much did you win or lose at the casinos, the aggregate amount was that people were ahead $6 billion at the casinos. There wasn't any losers. Here in Canada, we're reporting that we've lost twice as much as we actually have. So that's a big qualification with this 23%. Now, that's motivated a couple of secondary studies that we've done. We've used a diary method where we've had several hundred gamblers and several hundred problem gamblers keep a monthly day-to-day diary of how much they're spending on what thing. So at least they don't have to rely on memory so much. And at the end of this month, we'll be able to tabulate that data and see whether those reported expenditures more closely match government, horse racing, and charity revenues in that time period to better validate that 23%.
Thank you very much, Robert.
Well, you're welcome. Always a pleasure.
That was Dr. Robert Williams, an assistant professor in the School of Health Sciences at the University of Lethbridge and a member of the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Research Council, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Ingenuity, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Ducks Unlimited Canada, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Conservation Association, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, and the Science Alberta Foundation. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.